Several Texans said to be peacefully protesting seriously injured by so-called less lethal police force. What are the rules of engagement? We'll explore and more today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. How public perceptions of the events of the past several days may well turn on word choice. Also, some now say the time is right for a Truth and Reconciliation Commission concerning race in America. We'll look at how they've worked in North America in the past and whether one could make a difference now. Plus, the week in politics with the Texas Tribune and a whole lot more. Those stories coming up when the Texas Standard gets underway, right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on this fifth day of June 2020. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. Among the stories we're watching, a huge spike in hospitalizations for coronavirus in Texas. What appears to be one of the biggest one-week increases since the state began to fight the pandemic. There are now almost 1,800 people reported hospitalized due to the coronavirus in Texas. One other concerning metric, an 8.4% hospitalization rate, which is calculated when you divide the number of people currently hospitalized by the number of known active cases. These are numbers that Governor Abbott has said he's tracking closely as the state enters phase three of his reopening plan. We'll have more on that reopening of the fight against COVID-19 when we check in with the Texas Tribune a little later in the broadcast. In the meantime, demonstrations continue across the Lone Star State over the treatment of African Americans and people of color by police. Hundreds gathered in demonstrations in the Dallas-Fort Worth area demanding change with gospel songs and prayers in the streets on a day when a memorial service was held in Minneapolis for Houston native George Floyd, whose death has been ruled a homicide after a Minneapolis police officer knelt on his neck for almost 9 minutes. In recent days, anger has been rising over tactics the police have been using on demonstrators, too. Yesterday, Dallas Police Chief Renee Hall held a conference call with more than 30 community organizations, announcing a new policy. It imposes an affirmative duty on Dallas officers to intervene and stop an excessive or unwarranted use of force situation as soon as the officer witnesses it. The Texas Standard's Becky Fogel has been tracking the response to protests in other Texas cities.
In San Antonio Thursday, Alex Burnell told members of the city council it was time to invest in community resources rather than law enforcement.
Police, if you ask the average person, are supposed to enforce the law. We've expanded what enforcing the law means to cover social disorder, distress, and hardship.
Meanwhile, in Houston, City Council member Edward Pollard told residents the focus should not be on cutting funding for the police department.
The bigger question and the bigger concern is how can we make our police department even better and hold them accountable for any of the misconduct that some of the officers display so that we can increase the trust between community and police.
Hundreds of people signed up to speak at an emergency Austin City Council meeting Thursday. It focused on how police responded to protests last weekend. Samuel Kirsch said officers fired projectiles at him, hitting his face.
I suffered a broken nose. I believe it was also 5 or 6 broken bones near my upper cheek and the bone supporting my eye.
Austin's police chief agreed to bar officers from firing bags with lead pellets into crowds. Officers shot what's known as beanbag ammunition at protesters last weekend, critically injuring a 20-year-old black man who is a student at Texas State University. In Austin, I'm Becky Fogel for the Texas Standard.
Let's focus on that use of what police call less lethal force from the perspective of a police officer. What takes a protest from being peaceful to one where they feel such tactics are justified? It's an especially urgent question, as we've seen in Texas, some of those tactics used against demonstrators, leaving people critically injured. Eric McGuire is a professor of criminology and criminal justice at Arizona State University, where he also serves as an associate director of the Center for Violence Prevention and Community Safety. His area of expertise is police response to protests. Professor McGuire, welcome.
Thank you so much.
So what is the typical police strategy when it comes to whether to use escalation or de-escalation tactics during protests?
Well, we've got 18,000 different police departments in this country and a highly localized system of policing. And so it's all across the board. Some agencies tend toward strategies that rely more heavily on de-escalation, and some rely more heavily on their riot control training when dealing with protests. And often those approaches tend to escalate matters.
So how does one define peaceful protest? And I'm not sure if there is a First Amendment definition, but looting, damage property, I suppose, what, those actions could prompt use of force. But what about yelling at an officer, maybe standing in the middle of a street during a curfew?
What we talk about is based largely on crowd psychology research, is that when protesters are engaged in peaceful protest and lawful protest, and by that we typically are referring to they're not engaging in theft, they're not engaging in property damage, and they're not engaging in violence, then police ought to be, at least in the United States where we have First Amendment rights, ought to be trying to facilitate those protests rather than shut them down, even if they get loud, even if they get disorderly, and even if they're difficult to take for police. This gets much more difficult in the context of violence, looting, property damage, fires, and these kinds of things. And so, you know, staying out after a curfew in and of itself, and yes, it's a violation of the law, this is one of those instances where I think thoughtful police leaders really need to think carefully about, is it worth it, particularly in the midst of a global pandemic, to be making arrests and especially mass arrests for curfew violations? You know, that's a judgment call for police. And so when you have peaceful protesters, you facilitate their right to continue engaging in that protest activity. And when you have a subset of that crowd that's engaging in more criminal behavior, as we're seeing in this past week, police need to take enforcement activity against those people. The mistake we're seeing is that when you have a small subset of a crowd engaging in crime, police taking enforcement activity against the entire crowd.
I'm thinking about some people who may not be following the protests terribly closely, but they certainly know about the violence that's taking place in the streets. They start to see Humvees and they see a more massive police presence in riot gear. And now, as we've been hearing over the past couple of days, less looting. And they say, well, you see there, this is what happens when you step it up and you show them you mean business. I'm curious, what does the evidence show about the effectiveness of increasing police force or making a show of force? Does it in fact curb the behavior police are trying to stop?
You know, when enforcement activity is being focused towards looting and rioting and violence, it of course can have a deterrent effect, and it should have a deterrent effect. We don't want that activity going on in our communities. Where we see the backfire effect is when those enforcement activities, the use of force, the use of arrests, is being directed at peaceful protesters. And the evidence is very clear that when we see that happening, we tend to see an escalation in grievance, an escalation in a sense of unfairness among the crowd. And that's where you start to see defiance and rebellion. And one of the things that really scares me about what's going on this week is that in the past, we have multiple instances of police officers being assassinated after the types of things we've seen this week. And that's what scares me, is that, you know, there are people out there in the country right now who may have mental health problems, mm-hmm. access to weapons, and they're seeing what they consider to be, you know, grossly unconstitutional and unfair behavior on the part of police. And, you know, they may want to take that out on police.
We should talk about what police departments, in fact, actually use when they are responding to protests and certainly looting and violence. Out come so-called less lethal weapons like rubber or wooden bullets, tear gas, beanbags, which are not actually filled with beans, we should hasten to point out. But a Dallas man reportedly lost his eye, and a college student was critically injured by what police described as a less lethal weapon. Could you talk a little bit about the risks there?
Yeah, and so, you know, previously these were referred to in the policing industry and by the vendors as non-lethal weapons or less than lethal weapons. And they had to change the terminology because people die sometimes when being struck by these weapons. People are sometimes seriously injured as a result of these weapons. We have to be really, really careful about the use of these weapons. They're not intended as punitive measures. They're intended to aid in crowd dispersal after a legal dispersal order has been issued, and there are very clear conditions under which they're supposed to be used. And I'm seeing a lot of evidence this week of them not being used under those conditions. And in addition, we have to be really careful about, you know, if we choose to use those weapons, where we aim them and where people are struck with them. You're not supposed to be aiming at vulnerable areas like the face, head, or neck. You know, those are places where if people are struck, they can sustain really serious damage, particularly with the eyes.
Professor, do you believe police departments in the U.S. are, generally speaking, properly trained when it comes to handling protests?
No, and not at all. But I do believe that they're properly trained for handling riots. And so what's happening is police, because they're not properly trained in handling protests, treat protests as if they're riots. And what we know from the research evidence is that when you do that, when you over-respond to a protest, treating it prematurely as if it's a riot, you can actually escalate what's going on with the crowd and help to almost create a riot. And so we need to teach police more effective solutions for preventing riots, not just responding to them.
Edward McGuire is a professor of criminology and criminal justice at Arizona State University, where he also serves as an associate director of the Center for Violence Prevention and Community Safety. Professor, thank you for speaking with us on the Texas Standard.
Thank you so much.
Social media editor Wells Dunbar has been following what Texans are talking about on this Friday. Hello there, Wells.
Hello, David. We're hearing from folks on social media about the topic just at hand, the use of force by police against protesters and just when it is warranted. Via Twitter, C'est Moi says, as far as I can tell, there are no rules of engagement, just a patchwork of different police departments with rogue officers acting on emotion. I'm appalled to see a multitude of clips of cops pushing, shoving, knocking over, and kicking people minding their own business. Also via Twitter, Real World 2018 adds, we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that police are public servants, state employees. And meanwhile, over on our Facebook page, David King says, I cannot blame law enforcement officers for gearing up as they do. They are preparing for the worst, but hoping for the best. However, Matt Weiss, also on our Facebook page, adds that if the countless video examples that have arisen in the past week are any indication, there are no rules of engagement or accountability. He ends with a call to defund the police nationwide. A range of responses we're seeing on this and several other stories heading into the weekend, David. I'll be back with more of those reactions via social media later in the program.
The Austin American-Statesman reporting that Austin police are going to stop using those beanbag loads after protest injuries. There's a whole lot more coming ahead on the Texas Standard. Stay with us.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. All this week, as protests have dominated the attention across much of the Lone Star State, Texas Democrats have been holding their state convention all online for the first time. Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider takes a closer look at how the event's been unfolding and why Texas Democrats are so confident this will be their year.
Conventions are typically a way for a party to make a show of strength, bringing tens of thousands of followers together under one roof. So how do you measure your strength when the convention is virtual?
Yesterday, we blew all of our online fundraising records out of the water for the first day of our convention.
That's Luke Warford, the Texas Democratic Party's voter expansion director. We spoke Tuesday, the second day of the convention. Warford says all those resources will help with what he calls the largest voter registration effort in the state party's history.
If you look at the unregistered population in Texas, it's probably somewhere between 5 and 6 million people. So that's really a huge population of unregistered voters that we think should be registered.
The party set a more modest goal of registering 2 million through October 2020. They're counting heavily on mobilizing the state's non-white population.
The context here is that the unregistered population of the state leans heavily Democrat because it is young and it is diverse.
That was the focus of two panel discussions midweek. The first one, on the Latino vote, sought to dispel the idea of the bloc as a sleeping giant.
It's not helpful to Democrats, it's not helpful to Latinos, and it's not helpful to getting Donald Trump out of the White House.
Mayra Macias, executive director of the Latino Victory Project, said Latinos may hear that phrase and think their vote doesn't count.
One of the things that we did early on this cycle, whenever a reporter talked to us about the Latino vote, was reiterate the number that 32 million Latinos are going to be eligible to vote in 2020, making us the largest non-white ethnic voting bloc.
State Representative Rafael Anchia, chair of the Mexican-American Legislative Caucus, said Latinos were tired of voter suppression. He likened the behavior of Republicans like Attorney General Ken Paxton to schoolyard bullies. Paxton's led the charge to limit mail-in voting.
I want people to be pissed. I want people to be mobilized. And I want people to punch these bullies in the nose with their vote.
At times, though, the convention seemed out of touch. Many of the panels were pre-taped. The discussion on winning the black vote had no mention of George Floyd's death and the nationwide protests that have followed. Speakers in that panel emphasized the need for candidates not to take black voters for granted. Tracy Scott, president of the Black Women's PAC, said candidates need to show where they stand on issues of economic justice, and had a message for presumptive Democratic nominee Joe Biden about the South Carolina primary that revived his campaign.
Angela Rye made this great quote the other night on social media, and her statement was, "Jesus was to Lazarus as black women were to Biden."
But speeches tonight and Saturday are expected to address Floyd's killing and protests. The party's Luke Warford says,
"Look at the lineup of people who are coming, who are engaged here, right? It's Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, Elizabeth Warren, Speaker Pelosi. The list goes on and on. And I mean, I think that level of excitement and interest is because people know we can win this year."
Warford says the Biden campaign plans a big investment to get out the vote, and sees Texas as its largest battleground state. A Quinnipiac University poll released midweek showed Biden in a dead heat in Texas with President Trump. I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, providing community relief actions for the COVID-19 crisis, including early dividend distribution to eligible policyholders. More at texasmutual.com/dividends.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. The Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act, better known as the CARES Act, is the largest economic stimulus package in U.S. history. $2 trillion meant to help families, businesses, and cities stay afloat. This bill was passed back in late March, and the money is still making its way to recipients, some of whom are now learning that there may be more strings attached than they previously anticipated. To tell us more, we're bringing in Darren Liker. He is the city manager of Wichita Falls, Texas. Mr. Liker, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
First, how much money was the city of Wichita Falls originally entitled to under the CARES Act, and how much have y'all received so far?
Well, our grant allocation was for an amount up to $5.8 million. We've not received any so far, and there's a little bit of a caveat with that. The Texas Department of Emergency Management said, here's your grant allocation, but we're only going to release or allow you to draw down 20% of this funding at this time. So what we have to do is incur the eligible costs and request that 20% at this time, and then they said we might allow you to draw down the rest of it with proper documentation. The difficulty is there's a requirement that 75% of that money must be used for three categories, and so those categories are fairly rigid. The 75% is for things like medical expenses, direct public health expenses, and payroll for only those working on COVID-related activities. So for us, that's only about $300,000 to date. You can't set up programs such as public assistance or economic development grants for small businesses. So it comes with lots of strings attached.
Let me make sure I understand this. A lot of city governments will be and have been hit hard by the downturn in the economic situation, the lack of revenue coming into city coffers. And of course, you know, you have a lot of work that, even though it may not be directly related to COVID-19, has been profoundly affected by this pandemic. you're saying that unless you can, what, draw a direct connection, or, for instance, if you have money already budgeted, these funds won't go to offset those already budgeted expenses?
Absolutely correct. To give you a quick example of that, let's say in the fire department budget, we had a certain amount budgeted previously for overtime. Well, even if firefighters were using overtime because of COVID-related activities, since we had that money budgeted, we would have to exceed that amount before we could draw down from the grant.
I know you've been burning the midnight oil to try to figure out how to sort of bridge the gaps in your budget. What are you going to do?
Well, we've taken lots of steps already. We immediately put hiring freezes in place, travel training freezes. All non-emergency spending has been suspended since about the middle of March, and even looking at other possible personnel reductions and things like early retirement incentive programs to try to reduce payroll costs and the like, because the city government, 70% of our total cost is personnel related. It's hard to cut your budget without impacting the bodies, the personnel in that department.
Sounds like you're suggesting layoffs or furloughs.
That's on the table. We're not quite there yet, but that's certainly something we may have to implement.
Do you get the sense that when it comes to the strings attached to the CARES Act grant that a lot of other cities in Texas are surprised by these stipulations?
I think so, and maybe not so much surprised, but frustrated. I communicate regularly with a lot of other city managers around the state, and we kind of commiserate, if you will, about some of these rules that kind of tie our hands. And we all have discussed the fact that unless some of these rules are relaxed to a degree, a lot of this money to cities may go unspent.
Darren Leiker is the city manager of Wichita Falls, Texas. Mr. Leiker, thanks so much for sharing with us your experience on the Texas Standard.
My pleasure.
Support for Texas Standard comes from White Mountain Bulgarian Yogurt, family-owned and operated in Austin, Texas for 40 years. Learn about the value of eating traditional Bulgarian yogurt at whitemountainfoods.com. Available in the dairy aisle.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. The 5th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals is not letting Texas expand its ballot-by-mail program during the coronavirus pandemic. KUT's Ashley Lopez reports the stay will remain while legal challenges move through state and federal courts.
The court sided with state officials who have argued allowing more people to vote by mail violates Texas law. Texas has one of the strictest vote-by-mail programs in the country. The program is mostly available to people over 65, out of town, or disabled. But voting rights groups and the Texas Democratic Party argue people who do not have immunity to the coronavirus can be harmed by going to a polling site, which allows them to seek a mail-in ballot under the disability category. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton has argued that voters shouldn't be able to use the threat of COVID-19 as a measure of who can vote by mail. He has also argued without proof that expanding the program will lead to fraud. According to years of studies and research, however, fraud in U.S. elections is extremely rare.
Ashley Lopez reporting. Advocates are urging state officials to take steps to address the disproportionate impact COVID-19 is having on communities of color throughout Texas. Bob Sanborn, who heads the group Children at Risk, spoke during a news conference Thursday.
We need things like our leaders to restore in our state an Office of Racial Equity. We need for our leaders, for our governor, I would like the governor to say we want to establish a task force in our state to work on these issues around racial equity.
Texas opened a Center for Elimination of Disproportionality and Disparities in 2010. The agency, later renamed the Office of Minority Health Statistics and Engagement, closed down about 2 years ago after lawmakers cut the agency's funding. It examined racial inequities in government services. Texas oil and gas operations have plunged in the past few months, according to the number of new drilling permits issued by the Texas Railroad Commission. The agency, which regulates the industry, reports permits for new wells in May were down more than 300% compared to last year. Ed Longenecker is president of the Texas Independent Producers and Royalty Owners Association. He expects the decline to continue as producers shut down rigs due to a collapse in oil prices.
It could be mid or late next year until we really start to see the industry turn around. And some are projecting even 2022 until we get back to some level of normalcy.
Longenecker is part of a task force working with the Railroad Commission and lawmakers to develop policies to support the Texas energy sector during the economic downturn. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
You're listening to statewide news from public radio stations across Texas. This coverage is only possible because of support from listeners like you. You can help sustain and grow Texas news coverage by donating to your local public radio station today.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Journalism doesn't tell us what to think, but what to think about. So says Maxwell McCombs, the University of Texas media scholar, famous for his theory of how news coverage sets the agenda. But what we do make of the news we hear may well be shaped by the words journalists use, with profound implications for everyone. Danielle Kilgo, Ph.D., is professor of journalism, diversity, and equality at the Hubbard School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Minnesota. She's also a former Texan and co-author of a new study called Protests, Media Coverage, and a Hierarchy of Social Struggle. Professor, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
What inspired you to do this study in the first place? What's the backstory?
I had worked a lot on media portrayals of protests that followed the death of Trayvon Martin and Michael Brown and Eric Garner and Tamir Rice. And then as I continued to find the same patterns in press coverage over and over and over again, I decided to team up with a scholar, Summer Harlow, at the University of Houston. We actually based this study on Texas newspapers, large metropolitan areas, Houston, Austin, Dallas. And then we also took a sample of papers that represented each of the regions of Texas, so east, west, north, and near the border. So we used those newspapers and their digital coverage to help us be able to analyze an entire article, all of the pieces that that went with it, so the headlines and the text and the pictures.
Well, let's get down to how this matters or why this matters in the real world. I know that many listeners have been following closely the coverage of what's been going on in the nation's cities. And I've heard it described variously as protests, demonstrations, on occasion riots. I've heard the words mob used. Why do these words matter when it comes to how we think about what's going on?
They really define and they have connotations behind them that evoke crimes in people's heads. So if I call someone a rioter, they automatically think they're violent and they're not supposed to be there and they're criminal. Same goes for criminal and thugs. There's a long discussion that has happened publicly about whether or not the word thugs, for example, is a racist term. So a lot of times, especially when it comes to Black civil rights protests, these terms help portray protesters as violent and can contribute to the polarization around the support for the movement.
But wait, as I've been watching the coverage, there's been a concerted effort to avoid calling the protesters violent, to talk about peaceful demonstrations, peaceful protesters, as contrasted with the looting and violence that the camera catches at nightfall.
And this is certainly a new development. We do have this nuance that's provided to the protester group. We have traditional social media actors and social movement actors. And then we have, the crowds of people that are upset and ready to jump into this movement. And then we also have, agitators who have different identities. Maybe they're agitators affiliated with the same idea or grievance with the movement. But then we also have what some mayors have said are white supremacist agitators that are trying to intentionally hurt the cause. The other thing that's very different is that we're protesting in the midst of a pandemic. What a lot of headlines say, are protesters going to fuel COVID? That kind of blame, are they going to fuel the pandemic and crisis that we were sitting in before this all started? And I think there's been quite a bit of attention to police behavior and police militarization, especially as police have injured journalists. That is unusual. We saw that went viral, the cover from Slate that placed police officers as the instigators of violence. And though that is typical for some protests, that is not typical for protest coverage.
I want to focus on the dog whistle aspect of the choice of words, that politicians will often use certain keywords that they believe will stimulate greater response from voters. As so many questions have been raised in our partisan society about the media, I suppose it's really fair to ask then, if politicians are picking and choosing words, is there any reason people shouldn't be suspicious of how those words are chosen by journalists too?
Right. I mean, journalists, first, they have the opportunity to amplify or de-escalate what politicians say, right? But journalists and their norms and their routines, they have these particular words that they've used for a long time. And I think that journalists and audiences need to be ready to critique and think about the true definitions and meanings behind the words that they're seeing. Words like riots, are they riots or are they rebellions or are they revolutions, right? What are we really seeing? Are they clashes? Are people really just meeting up to go and bang into each other? Or is there something that's instigating that? So I think, you know, as we encourage journalism to shift, to use the active voice in headlines and in their, you know, leads of their stories, that identifying the actors and what they're actually doing will help sort of ease out of the language norms that journalists have used to cover protests for a very long time.
Danielle Kilgo, PhD, Professor of Journalism, Diversity, and Equality at the Hubbard School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Minnesota. Professor, thanks so much for spending a few minutes with us on the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, dedicated to the fight against cancer through telemedicine, providing patients with the ability to conduct online virtual appointments. More at texasoncology.com.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Is it time for the U.S. to have a reconciliation commission? Some are saying that the events of the past week and the reasons for those protests underscore the need. Perhaps the most well-known Truth and Reconciliation commissions took place in South Africa after apartheid in 1995. Though South Africa may seem a world away, closer to home, we've had reconciliation commissions too. And Larry Schuller, PhD, has been studying them. His forthcoming book is called Truth Talks, Resolving Conflict Together in North America's Truth and Reconciliation Commissions. Larry Schuller, welcome to the Texas Standard.
David, I'm very happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, I think a lot of people will be surprised to hear that there have been reconciliation commissions in the United States, and you focus on three places in particular in North America, North Carolina, Maine, and Canada. What's the backstory there?
It's a really interesting backstory, really backstories. In Greensboro, North Carolina, a commission was formed to evaluate a shooting that involved the Ku Klux Klan and what was known then as the Communist Workers' Party that took place back in 1979. The criminal trials resulted in no guilty verdicts, and so there were a lot of folks in Greensboro who felt that it needed to be dealt with more directly. They even flew Desmond Tutu in from South Africa to help inspire their work, so they formed the first Truth and Reconciliation Commission in the U.S. back in 2004 and completed their work 2 years later. In Maine, they were examining the challenges associated with fostering Native American children often away from their tribes and into families that proved to be either abusive or at the very least depriving them of connections to their tribe and to their heritage. Some actually called it a form of cultural genocide. And in Canada, the commission was set up with a similar focus on what was known as the residential schools, which were set up for the First Nations Indigenous children. So race, as you can hear there, played a pivotal role in all three commissions, even though they came from different specific origins.
Well, the question is, what counts as success in commissions such as these? Did ultimately the reconciliation that was sought happen?
Well, that I think that's the important question to ask. And quite honestly, my take is that calling them Truth and Reconciliation Commissions places an incredible burden on the commissions. But what we've seen in all three settings are cases in which the different sides to the conflict have either directly apologized to one another, directly, you know, embraced one another, either metaphorically or sometimes even literally, or at the very least agreed to work together towards common purposes.
You're not an outside observer when it comes to the events of late, and I suppose you must have been giving a lot of thought to whether or not a reconciliation commission for the U.S. might be due or perhaps even overdue. What do you think?
Overdue would be my answer to that, David. I really think that we have tested various other forms of making progress on these critical issues of race and policing and public safety, and those tests have failed. You know, we've tried to protest in the street, we've tried to loot, we've tried to litigate and prosecute. So from where I'm sitting, we've got to take a chance on a concept that may feel a little bit foreign to an American audience, but has proven to be impactful in a lot of different parts of the world, including in the United States and Canada.
Truth and reconciliation commissions, call them what you will. I realize what you're, the caveat there that you're making when it comes to putting so much on a commission, truth and reconciliation, nonetheless, right, are not panaceas. In fact, to some, they unleash fear. And others would say, by focusing on the past, in a way you're giving a pass to politicians who can point to society's problems and say, it's not me, it's nothing I'm doing, it's not my policies. What I'm wondering here is, how can you get to reconciliation if you have such disagreement about these factors, to say nothing of what the truth, you know, really means?
Well, David, in my study of conflict resolution, one of the most enduring lessons that I've learned is that so much of what resolves a conflict is a party's feeling that they have been heard. And a Truth and Reconciliation Commission is among the most public and accessible kinds of processes associated with trying to work through a major conflict. I just feel like we have come to a place where the voices that need to be heard in order to help bring about the change that the country clearly needs can only come forward in a setting like a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, where there's not a looming threat of prosecution or of violence, where there's not a sanction forthcoming, but where the whole point is just to chart a course forward together and not necessarily bequeath that responsibility just to the political class or otherwise.
But what if not all parties are willing to come to the table? It seems like there has to be something to compel everyone to participate, no?
It would seem that way. I mean, that would be the intuitive response. And yet, the examples, you know, across the board have been that the parties that might have been called the responsible ones have come forward without the threat of a subpoena or without a subpoena. I think people on all sides welcome the opportunity just to make their case, whether they be perpetrators or not. I mean, in Greensboro, the Ku Klux Klan participated fairly robustly in the commission process, and a lot of what they said was very uncomfortable for people. But I think it really changed the trajectory of that commission's work and inspired a lot of other organizations around the world.
I can imagine a lot of nonprofits wanting to perhaps start a reconciliation commission of their own. It seems like there's a through line here, though, in those reconciliation commissions that have succeeded in the past. There has been government involvement, no?
When you look at the three that I studied most closely, Canada, Maine, and Greensboro, Canada had such full-throated support from the national government there that the commission actually at one point sort of told them to back off. But I mean, one thing that I think is significant is that Canada's commission not only has the full support of the Trudeau, the national government, but also has either enacted or started enacting something like, you know, 3/4 of their 94 calls to action. In Maine, there was gubernatorial support initially, but essentially the commission functioned as an independent entity. And in Greensboro, the city council actually took a vote along racial lines to oppose the work of the commission once there had been a change in the mayor position and it became an African-American woman, that you started to see official city apologies and support for historical markers and support for some of the other commission recommendations. So it's actually a very delicate balancing act between, you know, government support to the point of interference and, you know, government distance to the point of opposition. You kind of have to find some place in the middle, I think.
it is not beyond the realm of conception that the result or the outcome of a reconciliation commission in the United States dealing with race could result in reparations. There are many who resist that. Should that be considered separately from reconciliation talk, or are they inherently part of that same conversation?
Well, Truth and Reconciliation Commissions stem from this whole idea of restorative justice, which is meant to bring about repair. And obviously, repair and reparations are, you know, from similar linguistic roots. I think that a commission should not be told at the outset to take anything off the table. I just think that the important thing is for the conversation to be an open one.
Larry Schuller, PhD, is the author of the upcoming book, Truth Talks, Resolving Conflict Together in North America's Truth and Reconciliation Commissions. Thanks so much for spending a few minutes with us on the Texas Standard. We certainly do appreciate it.
It was my pleasure, David. Thanks for having me.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas A&M University, dedicated to making a college education available to all who seek it. Details about how Texas A&M fulfills its land-grant mission at keeplearning.tamu.edu.
I'm David Fruchter, and I'm with the Typewriter Rodeo. We're a group of friends who take our vintage manual typewriters to various events and write custom poems on the spot. Phoenix Times, for Texas Standard listener Sarah Garrett. Sometimes a fire burns so bright you feel like you're consumed, your old life all in ashes, your only meetings zoomed, a catastrophic rearrangement of everything you knew. You feel at times your near derangement. Sometimes I feel it too. But I tell you, something new is stirring in the ruins of the old, a spirit rising up among us, burnished bright and bold by sheer disaster. Essence shines when dross is burned away. Riven by loss, but driven by love, we will seize the day and take the pieces torn and scattered of what came before and build with them a kinder world. That is what's in store. If we learn what we are shown, and I believe we will. So hold fast, keep safe, and I'll see you then. Until, my friends, until. I'm David Fruchter with the Typewriter Rodeo, and you are listening to the Texas Standard.
Support for the Typewriter Rodeo comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
Got an idea for a poem? Let us know. Send us your request on social media or email us, texasstandard@kut.org. You can keep up with the Typewriter Rodeo anytime on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Time now to turn to the week that was in Texas politics, as we do each Friday. Joining us again, Alex Samuels, political reporter for the Texas Tribune. Welcome back, Alex.
Yeah, happy to be back.
All right, this week we learned of Governor Greg Abbott's plan for Phase 3 of the state reopening. What do we hear from him? I understand what businesses to operate at 50% capacity effective immediately. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. In addition, restaurants which were permitted to be open at 50% capacity can immediately increase their table size from 6 to 10 people. And then on June 12th, they can ramp up capacities to 75%.
And all this despite news that Texas is lagging when it comes to the number of contact tracers that the government wanted to hire before June 1st. What's the latest there?
So the state has fallen more than 25% short of its goal for contact tracers. One of the governor's reopening metrics for June 1st called for up to 4,000 Texas contact tracers, but officials said Thursday that there were only 2,900 working around the state.
And of course, we've also seen a spike in the number of hospitalizations related to the coronavirus as well. Has the governor had anything to say about that, to your knowledge?
I don't believe so. I know that he's prioritized the daily number of hospitalizations, and he's been, tracking that when he looks at reopening metrics.
The Republican National Committee, as I understand it, might have Texas in its sights to be part of its convention in August. That seems to be rather breaking news, no?
Yes. So Dallas is among several cities that the RNC officials are considering as they look to replace Charlotte, North Carolina, as a location where the president will accept his party's nomination for re-election. So officials pull out of North Carolina amid coronavirus restrictions, and Trump said on Tuesday that Republicans are essentially forced to seek another state for the convention.
We should, of course, talk about the protests against the use of force and police brutality that are ongoing in many cities across Texas. And this development, now four Texas GOP county officials under fire for comments they made on social media, even Governor Abbott weighing in. What's going on?
So Abbott and other top Republicans called for the resignation of the GOP chairs in both Bexar and Nueces counties yesterday afternoon after both shared racist conspiracy theories on Facebook, alleging that George Floyd's death in Minneapolis was a, quote, staged event, apparently to gin up opposition to President Donald Trump.
Now, you mentioned two officials. Weren't there four in total?
Yes. Yeah, so there was one. The GOP chairman-elect in Harris County posted an image on Facebook earlier this week that showed an MLK quote on a background with a banana. And so the juxtaposition of the quote and the banana could be read as an allusion to equating black people with monkeys, another very well-known racist trope. And then the last one was actually flagged by the Texas Democratic Party. It was shared on Sunday by the chair of the Comal County GOP chair. That included an image of liberal billionaire George Soros with text alleging that he's paying cops to murder black people and then paying black people to riot.
You can read all about these stories and much more over at texastribune.org, where Alex Samuels is political reporter. Alex, thanks so much and have a good weekend.
Thank you. You too.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar is our social media editor here at The Standard. Wells, what are folks talking about on social media?
Hey, David. Well, what a year this week has been. So we are hearing from people about their plans for the weekend this Friday amid these tense and historic times, and hearing quite a range of responses, as you might expect. This coming in via the Facebook page, Eric Metzi says he will peacefully march in solidarity with millions around the world. Jeff Green says he will be attending a event, Dallas Stand Up for Justice, which appears to be an event unfolding in Dallas this weekend. And Justin Klumpner says he will be double-checking all the spaces he exists in to make sure they are safe and inclusive. However, citing the ongoing coronavirus pandemic, Mark Holland says he's not doing anything other than staying home. You know, obviously that's still a going concern, as we were just hearing per your conversation with Alex Samuels there. Yet more going on out there, the normal stuff, daily life. Allie Reggioni, she says she will be celebrating her daughter's second birthday this weekend. And Jeff Martinez says he plans on taking a bike riding trip down to the beautiful city of San Antonio. Barbara Stansfield Terry has an interesting and weekend itinerary with an apt warning here. She says she'll be cooking, wishing for rain, and hoping the tropical storm heading towards Louisiana doesn't become Act 3 of what she calls the 2020 crap fest. And indeed, a tropical storm making any sort of landfall along the Gulf Coast there with a devastating effect would definitely add to our woes there. So obviously, lots of meteorologists, news organizations keeping a track on that, on, I believe, what is being christened, what, a hurricane or tropical storm Cristobal,
there, that's right,
as it could potentially impact the Gulf Coast there. I believe set to make some sort of landfall over the weekend, early Saturday morning, I believe,
that's
is
right.
what I'm seeing
that's
here.
Right. Yeah, in fact, it is finally moving faster over eastern Mexico, and it's supposed to be emerging into the full Gulf of Mexico tonight, and then it'll head towards some northern Gulf Coast landfall as a tropical storm by later Sunday. What we're seeing as we look at the most recent tracking map here is it seems to be making a beeline, at least as of last check, at Louisiana. It looks like parts of East Texas, far East Texas, might be affected by heavy rainfall. But the Houston Chronicle is reporting, Wells, that it looks like Houston will be spared, not affected by the tropical storm. Of course, this is one of many stories that we continue to follow. Keep it right here for the very latest. And you can keep up with the news 24/7 over at texasstandard.org. I'm David Brown. We hope you can join us again on Monday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family. Would your company or organization like to be a sponsor as well? Contact your local station for opportunities within your community. For statewide sponsorships, visit TexasPublicMediaNetwork.com.